Welcome to Solid Science, a podcast that is about soil.
Well, it's not about soil, but about its ecology and what we can learn from it. And it's about science.
Well, it's not about science, but how knowledge is produced. But it is about people.
It's not about people, but about their experiences.
Hi, I'm Romy, a young researcher that is fascinated by soils in extreme conditions.
And I'm Carlos, two soil macroecologists working in conservation ecology.
Today we will talk about Antarctic soils, and we invited Diana Waugh to talk with us about it. Hi Diana, it's nice to have you here. Can you quickly give us a short introduction in what you do and also about your past with Antarctic soils?
Sure. I am Diana Wall, and I'm honored to be here. I am a professor in biology at Colorado State University, and also I am the director of the School of Global Environmental Sustainability.
So, Diana, how did you get to the topic of Antarctic soils? How did you get to the Antarctic? So this is not something that you, I would imagine this is not something that you can just, you know, remember one day and go to the Antarctic like that.
No, it's very interesting how your career takes shape. I had a postdoc in Southern California, and I was from the East Coast, where there are lots of trees and forest, and I loved that. And when I got to California, there's lots of deserts. And my postdoc was to examine the four deserts of the Western US and to look specifically for, calculate the energetics of nematodes in the whole system. There were other people doing plants, there were other people doing, you know, plant roots, animals and all that sort of stuff. And since nematodes, which is what I love and what my PhD was in, were numerous, they said, okay, we need you to calculate the energetics. And so I had to sample places like Nevada test site every week. And, you know, you had a regimented sampling scheme. And from there, I began to love the Jornada, the Chihuahuan Desert. And there were a group of ecologists studying everything from, you know, we poured nitrogen on the soil and had a lot of water. We had lots of manipulation experiments for about 10 to 15 years. We looked at a lot of soil organisms. And then what happened was I just got frustrated because we were trying to look at, you know, water additions, actual adding water at different levels on the dominant plant species. We were trying to manipulate the climate, in other words, and give the desert more water, what would happen below ground. And it just got very frustrating because plants seem to have a dominant effect with their roots on the amount of carbon and the soil food webs and the carbon that flows through the below ground system. And we could only study groups of animals that had same functions, very much like what are the plant feeders? You know, we still do it today because we couldn't identify all the species. The best we could do would be in the plant parasites, plant feeders. And so we were doing these functional groups, and it just got depressing. And my colleague, who I'm still working with, Ross Virginia from Dartmouth College, he would say, we're not going to be able to tease nematode species apart and see any effect. And meanwhile, this other colleague of mine who worked in Antarctica, I got to talking to him and I said, I need a desert. Not really a desert. I just need a place with no plants like Mars. And he said, oh, the dry valleys in Antarctica. You ought to look into it. And I said, send me some soil. Back though, in those days, you didn't need permits. And he just went out and sampled soil in Antarctica in the largest ice-free area, which is called the McMurdo Dry Valleys. And he sent me on a military aircraft bottles of soil. And I got a call to go to this military base and pick up a package. And here was this package of soil from Antarctica. And we immediately extracted or looked to extract nematodes. We didn't know what we'd get. And we found nematodes. They'd been found before, but nobody had looked at their distribution, whether they just occurred wherever it was glacial melts, melted streams, you know, with moist soil habitats. And so that was the beginning of it.
That sounds awesome.
Just serendipity. There was no direct career path to Antarctica.
So when we talk about Antarctic, especially also like dry and ice-free Antarctic soils, where are we talking about and what size are these areas?
The largest ice-free area is at 77, 78 South. And so we fly to Christchurch, New Zealand, and the U.S. has an agreement with the New Zealanders, have an Air Force base there. We get on military transport, just like, well, they use it for everything still. And it's about on a C-130, which is the aircraft carrier where we all line up on the sides. It's about an 8-hour flight. We land on ice runways in Antarctica at about 78 South. And if the ice has started to melt on the runway, they will use these large aircrafts. They have others that if they can get in on a frozen, like right now, I've got colleagues leaving next week for Antarctica, for McMurdo, and they will probably be on C-140s, which are only 5 hours. And the big difference is a C-130, the slower aircraft, you get out about 4.5 hours and all you can't talk because the noise is so loud on the plane. And the pilot will come down and he will look at everybody and wave. And then he will say, thumbs up, we go ahead. Soar a circle with his fingers. And it means, sorry, folks, the weather's bad in McMurdo. We've got to turn around and go back.
Oh, no.
And so we call those boomerang flights. And there's no frequent flyer mileage on them. So it is quite an ordeal. We've already packed all our gear by midsummer. By July here in the Northern Hemisphere and send everything we can. You know, we've outlined how many beakers we need. We've outlined how many microscopes we need. We've shipped all this stuff. And all we're allowed to take on the aircraft is about 30 pounds, which is not much if you've got a computer.
Yeah, sure. The one actually related to that, we had a similar conversation with someone that was sampling in the Amazon, and they would also fly in into these really small aircrafts, and they could only take I think it was 10 kilos or something like this of overall, or 15 of overall gear with them, nothing more. So I was wondering how are these sampling conditions in Antarctica? Because you take a minimum set, so you ship, you just said you ship everything up front, and then you take a bare minimum bag with you, and then you arrive to what is a really cold and dry system. So how is it sampling there?
Yeah, so McMurdo is like a mining town that was mining coal or something. So that's kind of where we have labs there, and we can look through the microscope and leave equipment there. And sometimes you can leave equipment that will be outside in wooden boxes the whole Antarctic winter. And so that is helpful. Then when we get there, we spend about, I would say, 3 to 4 days totally equipping a laboratory from scratch. So you just walk into a bare room and we immediately start getting the gear, all the microscopes and everything ready. And then we put in what we call helicopter ops. And again, this time we're only taking sampling bags, plastic bags with we try to have them pre-labeled because it's so cold outside. You know, when you label the bags, it's difficult to get it to stay. So we try to pre-label. We have to know exactly where we're going to be dropped off in the valley. So it's about a 40-minute ride in a helicopter across a frozen ocean to the continent where there is this large expanse of ice-free soil. It's about 4,800 square kilometers. And when you drop into it, it does look a lot like Mars. When you fly into this valley, it's a very, very large valley, or they're synchronous valleys that just are parallel to each other. that are of different ages since the last glacial maximum. We land, we take our gear, unpack the helicopter. While it's usually rotating, it leaves you with your survival gear, all our gear that we've hopefully brought. One time we forgot a screwdriver, which really caused some problems. We unpack our gear. We then take a break in terms of just, where are we going to sample Mars? That was our first, the first years it was like, oh my God, it's all the same. There's no trees, there's no forest. The rocks all look the same. How do you set up a transect except elevational or longitudinal? But, you know, as we got to know the valleys and the different where nematodes occurred in these dry spots, it was much easier to pick places to do experiments. Equipment-wise, all we take to the field is pretty much our sampling gear, survival bags, just the normal thing you'd take if we were going to do a soil bond experiment. You know, you take out pre-prepared stuff you're going to take. We try to then either go to a camp to spend the night. We usually, you know, it's 24 hours daylight, but the helicopters don't fly. You know, that we try to maintain regular nights and we can work and the helicopters just don't fly at the fake night. And so we then, we can do some things in the field, but you can't use glacial meltwater to extract nematodes very well because the valleys have different salt legacies. And so the waters have different composition of salts, and it really does affect the abundance and the species that are extracted. So what we do is we will maybe be out and have so many samples. The helicopter comes and gets us. We offload in town, what we call the mining town of McMurdo, and then go to the lab and we put the samples in the refrigerator immediately. And then either that day or the next day, we start weighing and sampling and doing the extractions and start counting right then. And we count all the demographics of every sample. So nematode, juveniles, living, dead. And the dead part was something that was just a shock to me when I got there, because here, nematode bodies decay very quickly because of the temperature and because of decomposition. We can find dead bodies in Antarctic soils, and it's really kind of interesting to see the demographic shift in the same soils over time. So that's, I don't know if that answers all your questions, but the sampling part is, you know, if we spend the night, we take sleeping bags or find out if there's sleeping bags in camps we can use, and we take our food.
One thing just on this, I know it's not relevant for the sampling, but when we met, the first time we met, I saw a picture of you with this gigantic red coat. And you had to explain to me that it had to be red.
Yes.
Because the helicopter is the only way that the helicopter will find you.
Sure.
And that I think at the time you were saying something that you had a student with you that didn't have or didn't take this type of equipment with her. And it was an issue for you because, the helicopter, there's no way that the helicopter will find you if you have any other color. You have to have, it's dramatic color on you.
It's how we identify. I think it's changed now. We can take our own gear. But Kiwis wear, you know, yellow and black or something like that. And the Italians really have nice field coverings. They're red and they're really very Italian. You know, they're beautiful. Whereas ours is just, we call it Big Red. And it's got lots of pockets in it, so you can put a soil sample in it. You can keep a pen next to your body so it's warm, so you can write when you take it out, that kind of thing. And I think the clothing, the distinguishing of the UN is by what kind of color of coat you have, all the nations. So it's kind of fun.
Okay, you mentioned the nematodes now quite some time. So is there a favorite nematode species that you personally have?
Oh, yes. Yes. And it ought to be everybody's favorite nematode. I was just reading a paper of a former student in my lab, and she looked at the climate history on the genetic structure of the favorite nematode. The dominant one, there's only a few species. So the point of looking, what we did first was to find out if there were nematodes anywhere distributed in the drier, saltier soils across the valleys, because that's the majority of the valleys is not near melt streams or frozen lakes. It is miles and miles of just dry, salty soils, and it's got different geological legacies, because it's been pushed in during climate change, last glacial maximum, or it stayed there. So the soil types are very, if you want to call them soil types, heterogeneous. Okay, the most dominant nematode in the salty soils, which is just amazing to me, is a nematode named after Sir Robert Scott, who was the first person in the valleys. Well, he was the first field team in the valleys. And the nematode's name is Scotnema. And the last name of it is Lindsayi, that was named for one of the people that found the nematode near a melt stream. He was from UC Davis. And so it's Lindsayi for his technician. Scotnema Lindsayi is gorgeous, and it's everywhere. And it doesn't like, its habitat is dry, salty soil. If it gets too close to streams and melt ponds or something like that, we just don't see it as much, and we see other species. We see two other species dominantly there. So they're just like wolves and elk. They have their different habitats.
Okay, that's interesting, because when I think of nematodes, I remember from soil books, they live around the soil particles in these water areas. But how is it in dry areas? Where are they living?
Well, for the whole winter, I mean, when it dries down, freezing is very much like, it's just a desiccation mechanism in nematodes. And so we now know from Byron Adams' work and Byron Adams' lab work and some work on mites by Jim Collins and Ian Hogg that these animals have survival strategies that if the weather gets bad in the middle of the day, like when we're there in the summer, and we have to put on our big red coats, and we're freezing, and the soils are desiccating because they're so low in moisture, it's about 1% gravimetric weight or less. They start desiccating, the nematodes start desiccating just like if they were in a hot desert. It's the same mechanism, except that they have hot and cold genes, and they also have anhydrobiotic genes, which even some plants have these for drought. And what happens when it gets to be winter for a longer period of time, they use their energy to switch to this anhydrobiotic, this life without water gene, and they change their biochemical pathway so that there's less water in their body, and they can change their morphological shape or not. Sometimes they coil, sometimes they don't, but they try to reduce surface area, and it's all very programmed at the same to survive, 8 months of freezing cold soil that has very low carbon content in it. And so that happens sometime, but usually they use these hot coal genes to turn upload. If it's just the summer and it, all of a sudden, like in an hour, you can tell that it's the temperature has dropped and the winds are coming and the soils are desiccating. And we don't see as many nematodes in the surface soils, like 0 to 3 centimeters. They're somewhere between 3 and 10 or 15, and then it's could be rock and more glacial soil. I don't know if that answers your question, but they're very, the animals that survive, the species that survive of nematodes all seem to use the same method or two methods, using hot and cold genes for short-term dryness or cold, and then a different anhydrobiotic gene to keep them over the winter.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, I didn't know that some organisms were able to do that. So that was already fascinating, but is there another exciting thing that you found in Antarctic soils that you want to share now?
Well, I think the body of the work, the way we work. So for the first few years I was down there, and it was just like, okay, are there nematode species here? Can we find a single species in a soil sample and nothing else? And if that's so, then we can do some experiments. And we set up in the first, I think, 2 years we were down there, warming chambers over the soils, and started looking at what would happen if climate change ever happened. We poured carbon on them, we had water, we had warming, temperature. And so we set out all these chambers and started looking at populations over time. And it was cold, the first really cold to us, and the temperatures show that. Probably the first 10 years of these long-term experiments. And then all of a sudden we got a sudden flood where we had melting permafrost and melting. It was a landmark I thought it would never happen again, so we did a lot of science that year. What was great was because we already knew the distribution of animals, where we would find the most species, where we would only find Scotnema, we were able to see changes across the landscape also in these experiments. And we kept these experiments running till about 2018. And then we said, okay, let's take off our added water. Let's take off all our manipulation of parts of the experiment. And let's see if the populations rebound from the flooding event, the warming events that started in 2002. And I'm losing where your question was, but the startling things were, what's going to happen with climate change that we were doing the manipulations of? But we also were able to look at had it already happened in elevation. So there's this great paper by Walter Andruzzi where he just said, we're predicting that Scotnema will expand, or we're predicting that it will not expand, but we can look at it because we've got mountains in these valleys with low temperatures at the top, you know, and we had had long-term plots there looking at them with temperatures over time. And he could see that there was more soil moisture melting and that we were seeing the shifts that you might predict in the future. So the more exciting thing we've been able to do now is some work that is in this paper that Abby Jackson has done. And that's looking at what is the effect of both climate history, what are previous climate change warming events? Because we can look at the geological legacy of the soils around them and tell how many years past glaciation, the last glacial maximum, and then say, okay, now we're seeing warming in the soils. How does that compare with the genetic structure? And so that's one where, well, it's been submitted. And so we're starting to look at that across the landscape to say, how is Antarctica going to change? We compare it with Australians' data, you know, along the coast, or other people who are looking at maybe a mite or Kalimbala. And it, because we've got single species, and because everything after the first 2 years I got there has been collaborative with geophysicists, geochemists. We have a stream team led by Diane McKnight, Mike Gusev, where they look at diatoms and they look at, you know, was the source of carbon wind blown from algae in streams? Was that the way? And then that's where the pockets of nematodes. That isn't necessarily true. And so we have a collaborative team that goes down that used to be about 31 people, all looking at terrestrial landscapes. The glaciers, are they melting? Is it the front of the glaciers that's melting? Are we getting more stream flow? Does that give us more moisture at a larger landscape scale? And then what happens to the only animals that are in the valley? There's nothing flying. There's just nematodes and a mite and Kalimbala. And so then we can start looking at what may happen with climate change. And so that's been, and then are they, how resilient are they? Will they stay in that place, or will they die off? And so that's kind of been the force of our experiments since about 94 long-term experiments. But the genetic structure and looking at that and using the information from the geochemist, we had a paper that's published. It was a Shackleton grant that Byron Adams and I and Noah Ferrer and a whole lot of people were on. And we went to, instead of 77 South, we went to, I think, 85 South, and looked at mountaintops that were really, really old and that have started having some, they were different in ages in the mountaintops. So they would have had different deposits of atmospheric chemicals. And some of these mountaintops would be more salty because they were older and these salts had been sitting there. And we projected that they wouldn't have, you know, all five species together. They would just have maybe one. And so we did that, and that was published. And so it kind of has led us into this climate history on the structure and what will happen with, how do we conserve them? We're very much into that. We've had meetings, you know, this is the great thing about Antarctica. We have these Antarctic meetings where the terrestrial people all get together and we start saying, okay, you've got an emperor penguin that's disappearing and you've got a tiny nematode that's disappearing. What should we conserve? You know, what's the difference in habitat? What are the factors we need to conserve this species? And so that can affect the Antarctic Treaty. So everything we do is usually to preserve the Antarctic environment. There's a high priority, I would say, on that for all nations that are there, all the scientists that are there.
What does it mean to preserve that area? So what are the effects of the global change currently? Will it get, like, as you said, a bit moist in some regions? Will it get warmer? And what does it mean for the ecosystem itself?
Well, it is going to be a huge transition. I mean, the geopolitics are very much like they were for the Arctic, or are for the Arctic right now. Countries won't land. Right now, they're talking about in Alaska growing all sorts of plants and adding fertilizers and, you know, on top of the peat and growing all. I mean, companies are racing to get there. In Antarctica, what's happening is nations are filing bioprospecting paperwork. And that is, so they've already got a school down there for kids. They fly kids. I mean, I about dropped dead. I was over in the Argentina side, and they have a plane that comes back and forth to this, you know, Palmer Peninsula, where there are lots of nations with, you know, with their McMurdos, little towns. And a kid got on the plane, and I hadn't seen a kid for 3 months. And here is this child getting on the plane. And I'm like, holy smokes. And then you look and you see there's a school. So people are trying, nations are slight. They're moving to get to soils that melt. And there's a paper that we did, a number of us did from across nations, that are talking about islands in the ice, where we're starting to see these islands of soil because climate change is melting down and there's land. And the land is going to be Mars. You know, they're talking about Mars. Let's establish communities. Well, Antarctica is already habitable if you can figure it out. People overwinter in McMurdo all the time. But it's this expansion of soil and land and the availability of water. So there's a lot of conservation. We've got a lot of conservation, I would say, papers, but we target them very specifically for the Antarctic Treaty because that's the body that will have to deal with the nations. Hopefully, not have some factory sitting down there. I mean, it's really kind of remarkable when you go back and look at the history, because everybody came to Antarctica because they were killing whales like crazy. And you can go in a ship around the coastline and see these mammoth type tin buildings where they were slicing and dicing the whales as fast as they could do it. I mean, it's just horrible. And then you go through this period where, you know, it's the place of adventure and science, which is what it is now. And then you start thinking, oh my God, they're going to, you know, they're already fishing. There's a big deal about the last pristine ocean right outside our lab window. And it's going to be difficult because there's too many nations.
So, Diana, I would like to maybe just take what you just said and connect it to how you introduce yourself. Because when you're introducing yourself, you say, well, I'm now the head of the Global Soil Biodiversity Initiative. And this is an initiative that is mostly connected to policy. Yeah. So, and to actually engage in a community of researchers everywhere and try to build capacity through that. So how do you reconcile the work that you are doing, or that you did in the Antarctic, and with all these issues that you are now raising, with the work that you are also now doing with high-level policymakers that are trying to, again, protect soils or protect soil communities in different ways? How do you reconcile these two?
Well, it's difficult because we use... I forgot how many tons. I've got a big poster on my door that says how many tons of carbon we burn just to get to Antarctica. We didn't know that at the beginning. You know, it was the scientist who said, we need to not litter. No, we don't pee in the valleys. We don't poop in the valleys. Everything goes in, comes out. all waste goes in and out. We weren't like that in 89, 90, 91. We were, you know, just like everybody else was pretty much. Then that changed pretty fast because you're looking at penguins, whales, things like that. The policy connection came really largely because the Senate and Congress of the United States sends a body of people, maybe 10, to Antarctica to see what in the hell the U.S. is paying for. They want to know. They come in and they talk to the scientist. The scientist will invariably talk about climate change and what's happening there. And not very far away is a Kiwi base, not very far away, is an Italian base, a German base, and a Korean base near us. That's pretty far south. And these guys will walk in the lab and say, you know, it could be the head of NSF. It could be the head of EPA. You know, they're princes and all that sort of stuff that come to the Kiwi base, not just explorers. And they want to know what the taxpayer is getting for their money. So I have, since some of us are in the field, sometimes our field team would be, we'd have like six on it, and there might be three students left in the lab running samples and identifying. When you walk in that door, when the senator walks in the door today and asks you what we do, you better be ready to explain. And so they come up with videos. They come up with, do you want to watch sex of nematodes happening? Look under this microscope. Why is that important? You know, we can't do this work in a freezer. We are the action guys on the ground seeing climate change occurring. And so we also, I have them do things like ask the senator, we know where they're from. We usually know what the passenger list is because we can see it on the board. And ask them, does your state do any agriculture? You know, so we try to tie, they do it in their own way, but there's a set number of things that we ask them. And are you interested in supporting soils nationally and internationally, as well as fishing and stuff like that? And bringing people together, having worked with scientists who, I don't know what they're doing, they don't know what I'm doing, and it takes about 3 years before we, you know, the geochemist can say, I never thought I'd love a nematode. You know, it's very different fields, but working collaboratively as we do, we all are very aware of policy internationally. We may go to somebody else's base and meet Prince so-and-so who's down, or the prime minister of so-and-so. So we're all very aware that what we do has to have relevance. And collaboration is the biggest way to get every, if somebody says to a geochemist, you've been working down here looking at rock formations and for years and years, is there any life here? They need to be able to say the only animals in the dry valleys are in soils. And so that just carries it on up. And so the collaborative factor, the force of having people who all work on soils of some area or some organism in soil is much more powerful, I think, than just, hi, I want to talk about my little nematode. You know, you got to put it in a bigger picture. I don't know if that answers your question or not, but it's been there a long time.
We only have one question left, and that's the one we always pose in the end. And that's the question, what can you recommend to young researchers in general?
I think everybody is aware that our ecosystems are changing, and there's a lot in an ecosystem. And we need people not only who are scientists, academicians, but we need scientists in many different jobs, whether they're teachers or whether they're radio announcers or whether they're TV announcers or work in policy or whether they work in the tropics. We need them to speak science, show them where the evidence is, and then also be very aware of the different parts of the ecosystem that we know so little about that are going to affect us in the future. changes in soil, changes in water, changes in plant productivity. I just think there's a lot to study from different angles, and you can do it whether you're an academician or you want to do something else, but use your science. So do it.
I fully agree.
Thank you very much, Diana. I think we should all do it.
Yeah, we have a lot to do, Carlos.
Yes. Thank you, Diana. So, Romy, what have we learned today?
We learned that there is a lot of dead bodies in Antarctic soils.
Okay.
Actually, I can relate to that. When I was sampling in Canada and I looked at the samples, I didn't know how much dead biomass there would be on the forest soils, actually. And yeah, of course, it's the same with nematodes, and of course, it's the same in the Antarctic, but I think we are not aware of that. Yeah. And especially in our region, larger things, they decompose very fast, so we can't see them anymore. You may feel some dead trees in the forest, and they get softened, and it's a really nice feeling to step on them. But in the Antarctic and in the smaller, on the smaller scale, we don't see all this dead biomass. And in colder regions and drier regions, it doesn't decompose. So it's existing for a long time.
Yeah, sure. It's a sea of dead bodies. That's true. Yes. But it's funny that you mentioned that, because in this decomposition rates, so when we talk about dead matter, we tend to forget that this means that the carbon is there, but it's not being decomposed fast enough, that is being incorporated into, you know, organic, so it's not available, let's say, to plants and to other organisms. And this shifts completely the type of ecosystem that we are talking about, because she was referring to the soils with lots of dead animals, but then she at the same time said, well, these soils are really low on carbon, because the carbon is not incorporated into the soil, although it's there, you know, as dead animals.
Yeah, that let me think now, maybe this ecosystem is just waiting for millions of years. So it's accumulating the carbon as dead biomass. And at some point when climate changes a lot and there is actually plants, because so far there are no plants, so
sure. Why
should you use the CO2? So in millions of years, you can then use all that dead biomass that accumulated over time, and then there can be another rainforest or something growing on top of it.
Yeah, that's a very hopeful idea, I guess. Another thing that surprised or interested in about many things, but there was another aspect of this. This was what she meant in the end. She mentioned in the end that was about these kids, these schools for young researchers or young, activists to go to the Antarctic and to experience what it means, you know, to be in a with minus 40 degrees all the time, you know. That was actually something that I never thought it would exist in such an environment. And I will have to look it up, because I found it really, really interesting.
It's a new form of ecotourism or adventure tourism, where you put yourself under the conditions that we have. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. I don't know. Well, if you see it like that, I was not thinking about that in that direction. But if you think about this situation like that, I would then come back to what Diana referred to, that in her career, the way that these bases, the science bases, were set up was on top of a coal mine or on top of, you know, industry that was there to kill whales. And that even shifted now even more, because now they go there with a really critical environmental conscience, to the point that everything that comes in has to come out. So they really, Diana didn't refer to this, but they even are careful with their footprints, because they, one thing that, I don't know if you know this, but when they are going to go, when they go to the Antarctic, they have to follow the same tracks so they don't step on the ice outside of these tracks. And this is a level of carefulness that you don't see anywhere else in the world. You know, it's being so careful that you have to backtrack your steps, not to crush the ice, you know, just 10 centimeters away from the track is really something, you know.
That's really fascinating, yeah. And that also fits well into her description as the Mars region. So it's like this uninvaded territorium, and maybe we have to keep it like that. We have to have these areas also in our world where the human footprint, the real footprint is not existing.
Yeah.
That's really nice.
That's true. That is true. I was talking the other day with a colleague about terraforming Mars, but yeah, maybe it's already happening here and we don't know it. Yeah. That's true.
Yes.
Okay, Romy, I think we meet each other next time. Yeah.
Yes. See you then.